bells are ringing, you can hear our mother singing, come on home, little children, come on home. Crows are flying in the skies, they've been plucking out the eyes of all those too blind to see. Soul is a bird.
Greetings to you, my sweet and beautiful water babies. It is I, D. Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And if this is the first time that you've allowed your ear fingers to gently roll against the back of this podcast as we lay in bed together, I welcome you. A little bit about me. I'm a quicksand survivor. I'm a proud lesbian mother of two beautiful children with expanded fontanelles. And most importantly, two children with a lot of heart, because they have made the decision to allow our family to offer them up to High Priest Nornon V this summer at the Bohemian Grove. I enjoy colostrum baths, and quite often you'll see me outside sunning next to my hot tub, which has been liberated so it goes above 104 degrees, rubbing a combination of oil, cream, and scented lilac leaves into my nipples, which have the largest natural holes of any woman's nipple in all of Southern California. I'm a channel for a barbarian warlord from the 5th century BC, and most importantly, I'm a scientist. I work at Laboratory 39L, and you are a beautiful man whose head has been shaved, body hair has been shaved,
and who is being held in an oxygenated cube of gelatin comprised of
1/3
mescaline and 3/4 sodium pentothal. We're broadcasting this into your mind as we erase your memories so that we can replace your identity with that of an assassin warrior who we intend to send to Costa Rica
on a very special mission called Sunlight
Tour.
Sunlight
Tour.
Sunlight
Tour.
In the meantime, we've got a
great podcast for you today
with a cult scholar and author, Jason Louvre. We're going to jump right into that.
But first,
some quick business.
Trying hard to remember.
This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the Sleep Geniuses, the Einsteins of Rest, over at Casper.com. Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. Their products are cleverly designed to mimic human curves, providing supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. Casper is affordable because they cut out the middleman, which means you don't have to go to some sleazy mattress warehouse and get your mind fucked by some mattress hypnotist who's going to make you spend $6,000 on a vibrating mattress because you're stoned and he can tell and he knows that you're sad and he knows that he can trick you into thinking that deep swirling void inside your heart can actually be satiated with a comfortable mattress, which it won't. There's no way to get rid of that. It's called fundamental dissatisfaction in Buddhism, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't have a wonderful night's sleep. Just because we're being aerosolized by time doesn't mean that we shouldn't get our full 8 to 10 to 15 hours of sleep. And Casper is the mattress to achieve this very, very noble goal. Free shipping and returns. That means you don't have to worry if you want to send it back. And you really don't have to worry if you want to send it back because they've got a 100-night risk-free sleep on it trial. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars across Casper, Amazon, and Google, Casper is becoming the internet's favorite mattress. It's delivered right to your door in a box. It explodes out of the box like a comfort tentacle reaching into this dimension from a dimension of amazing sleep. It's got just the right sink and just the right bounce, which is a family-friendly way of saying it's great for humping. I own a Casper mattress. I sleep on a Casper mattress. I just slept on a Casper mattress last night and had very strange, wonderful dreams. Casper, give them a shot. All you got to do is go to casper.com/family hour and enter in offer code family hour, and you will get $50 towards select mattresses by once again visiting casper.com/family hour and using promo code family hour at checkout. Note, this offer is only applicable to select mattresses. Purchases and terms and conditions apply. Give it a shot. Casper, sleep on a Casper. And here's something interesting that Casper won't mention, but that I've heard from one of the beautiful redbirds that sometimes lands on my window and talks to me. The Casper is the best mattress to die on. If you die on a Casper mattress, all of your past sins will be washed away, and you will be certain to take birth in a family of beautiful, wealthy intellectuals who are going to teach you the importance of love over money. Once again, that's casper.com/family hour. Use offer code family hour. It's time to sleep, 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 sleep. Here's something rad that I just found out about. I just did a podcast with the great Mark Duplass. I'm not going to be able to release that until May, but wow, it was a really good one. But he told me about this amazing charity called DonorsChoose.org. That's Donors, C-H-O-O-S-E.org. This is super cool. It's basically a way for you to help out teachers, and it's like a mini Kickstarter for teachers, I guess you could say. So I'm on the page right now, and for example, my students need a class set of the novel Salvage the Bones by Jesmyn Ward, and they need $35. That's all they need. They've already gotten 12 donors. This is Envision Academy of Arts and Tech in Oakland, California. So, like, it's a real hands-on, badass way to help teachers out and get the satisfaction of knowing that you're one of the very few people who help these particular teachers out. Like, look at this. With one drying rack, we can paint, create, and integrate. My students need a drying rack so they have a safe place to store their art projects each week. That's Ms. Bratz at Vaughn Next Century Learning Center, Primary Center, San Fernando, California. I mean, this is the sweetest thing ever. Stretching and shrinking candy bars. My students need calculators to see proportionality and scale ratios in real life by making giant candy bars. Miss Ingham from Oak Grove Middle School. What a sweetie. Swinging for the stars. My students need the pop-up batting cage to transfer skills learned on a tee or in the cage onto the playing field. That's Mr. Joyner. An organized garden is a happy garden. My students need to add to their gardening experience. We need a storage unit to store our tools in a way to naturally fertilize our plants and learn to recycle by using a composter. That's Miss Wickman at Lakeside Elementary School in Pembroke Pine, Florida. They need $56. So this is just a super cool way to help out teachers and to get that beautiful dopamine rush that comes from doing good things in the world. Much thanks to Mark Duplass for that philanthropic tip. And if you're not familiar with Duplass, you should definitely watch The Puffy Chair or Blue Jay or My God, If You Want to Shit Your Pants, Creep and Creep 2, which are all on Netflix. Friends, if you don't want opening rambling monologues and commercials attached to the interviews of this podcast, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/DTFH and sign up. You will have access to interviews that aren't on the main feed yet. Whenever I do an interview, I just upload it to the Patreon, commercial free, opening monologue free. It's a way for you to get extra episodes sooner. Also, I put up at least one stream of consciousness, rambling, embarrassing, if you ask me, overly intimate and confessional thing on there. I don't know, a rant, a thing. I don't know what you'd call it. A spew of garbled words. Certainly misconstrued understandings of complex things that I pretend to understand fully. It's all there for you at patreon.com/DTFH. Much thanks to those of you who have signed up. It's the number one way for you to support the DTFH. Okay, pals, let's get this show on the road. Today's guest is an author. He's an occult scholar. He's written many, many books and amazing articles on fringe culture, on magic. He actually teaches magic classes. You can take one of his classes by going to magic.me. That's M-A-G-I-C-K Me. We're not talking David Copperfield magic. This is Aleister Crowley, dimensional shifting opening riff style, potentially driving yourself mad and being devoured by hyperdimensional locust being style magic. Again, that's magic.me, magick.me. Also, he's been on the podcast two times before, and I'm super happy to have him back. Everybody, please call out to the Enochian angels and beg them to give their mercy and love to today's sweet guest, Jason Louv. Jason, welcome to the DTFH. Welcome back. Whenever I'm around you, I realize, okay, I've got to like take advantage of being around a sorcerer for a second. So let's just dive right in. No small talk. We were just talking about what I guess I would call energetic contagion, which is this thing where when you find yourself working on yourself in some way, you become contagious. In other words, like the best example and the positive example I could give is like getting around Ram Dass, you get high as a kite. And the only way I can compare it to is like, it reminds me of like, a hit of like very, 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 very clean LSD minus the hallucinations. So there's just this sense of expansiveness. You might start crying. Can you tell me a little bit about that? What is that? Is there anything through the lens of magic that describes what that is?
Yeah, this is quite a topic, right? So it's amazing you bring this up, and thank you for having me back, by the way.
It's dude,
it's
I love
always
being
super
around.
Super fun doing this show. I love this is thank like you. My favorite thing.
Thank you.
So I've got this book on John Dee coming out that I mentioned on the last podcast.
Yeah.
And he actually works this out in scientific detail, the theory of vibes coming off everything.
Right.
And so he wrote a book. So John Dee, obviously the great, you know, one of the greatest magicians of all time, the great Elizabethan magus and advisor to Queen Elizabeth I. And he wrote a book called The Propademata Aphoristica, which is obviously in Latin, where he develops the theory of light waves. And he says that there are rays emanating from everything in the universe. And he starts by talking about the planets and the stars. And so the obvious, so he says, yes, there are rays emanating from the planet Mars and the planet Jupiter and the moon, and these condition consciousness. So this is a segue into the theory of astrology. I'm not sure how I feel about astrology, but as a predictive science, but basically what he's saying is that just like the moon influences consciousness, the other planets do too. He believed that there were actually rays emanating from these things. I don't think that's scientifically valid, but it's certainly an artistic and poetic way to look at things.
Yeah.
But then he goes on to say, but there's also rays emanating from everything in the natural world. There's rays emanating from human beings. I think this is true. This is a metaphorical way of talking about this, but I think it's certainly true. The Buddhists talk about it also, where they talk about the interconnection of all phenomena, dependent arising. The Buddhists see the world as a network of consciousness and everything interacting with everything else all the time. I think if we were to look at that from a more scientific view, a more modern view, certainly I think that we're constantly picking up on not just other people's body language, but how their thoughts condition their body language, their attitude. And I've always thought of the word energy as kind of like a shorthand for all these things.
Mm.
We're constantly picking up on signals around us. So like right now we're sitting across from each other and we're picking up on all these nonverbal cues.
Right.
Body language, skin tone, pupil dilation,
yeah.
Certainly language. Even how I'm breathing and all these things. And we're kind of like reading all this complex information and then condensing it into a very almost a lazy shorthand called how I feel about the other person.
Yes.
Right. So I think that somebody who is, you know, for lack of a better word, a saint, right? Somebody who's cultivated deep states of meditative silence for long, long periods of time just reads differently from another person, and you just feel safe around them. Or you feel an expanded sense of your own personal potential. The Buddhists call this the Buddha field.
Right.
I don't know what the actual Tibetan word for that is.
An expanded sense of your own personal potential. And yet within that expanded sense, it's like you're almost getting to fast forward to what you will become or something. It's like you're getting a chance to, if what you were to become, oh, this is interesting. Okay. So conversely, let's say that you get around a real piece of shit, you know, like the opposite of a Ram Dass. And you get around someone who's like, I don't mean just like your average, like, hey, I'm a little irritated today, woke up on the wrong side of the bed. You get around that kind of person, at the very worst is annoying, but maybe you're going to actually want to cheer that person up, or you're this compassion. But I'm saying sometimes, and hopefully not too often, you get around someone who is there, it seems to have practiced their malevolence. You know what I mean? Where it's,
well, yeah, I mean, you look at the way that crowds responded to Hitler, or that, you know, you look at the way that people responded to Donald Trump in those rallies. You know, there's a lot going on where you're around the, and people are like that. They get very caught up in other people's stories and personal presence. And, you know, the 19th century occult theory for this was called, they called it animal magnetism.
Right.
So
is that Mesmer?
I think so, or it's certainly the same time period.
Yeah.
But we see it we see it with celebrities. We see it with people who are able to cultivate the ability to get a certain emotional reaction from people, because most people are unconscious and they're not in charge of their own mental states. So when you get around somebody who's a skilled manipulator, that, and like you said, that can be for good or evil,
or know? Just chaos,
right? Well, yeah.
You know,
right,
it could just be for just the sake of like warping stuff, but so now again, friends, this is, I always feel like the need to apologize to, I guess in my mind, I imagine Neil deGrasse Tyson listens to this, like my ego imagines there's someone out there who's like some scientific materialist, and I always feel the need to apologize to that fucking person, when the reality is, and no one like that probably listens to this podcast, but still in all, I do feel a need for like logic and being rational, and thus I need to preface like what I'm about to say by saying, I understand this is absolutely potentially ridiculous, but...
Well, I think it's important to do that, because I think that it's very, you know, like for me, right, like I've been talking about magic publicly for 2 decades now.
Yes.
And I've always made a real point to go at it from a rational angle as well as a mystic angle. And you need to be able to wear both hats. You know, Robert Anton Wilson always used to talk about in his books, like, you know, viewing things as a skeptic, viewing things as a believer, viewing things as, you know, all these different roles, and being able to be mentally flexible like that.
Yes.
Is incredibly important, because people who are just purely dogmatic scientific are fairly limited. People who are purely dogmatic mystical are really limited. But I really, you know, I think that now, particularly at a time when, you know, we have such an anti-science climate, a climate that is hostile to science. And I think that Trump's new science advisor he appointed is like a 31-year-old political science graduate or something like this. You know, like, trust me, we want scientifically educated people.
It's good. Well, yeah, you're right. I don't think there's nothing wrong with like paying deference to the rational. But I like what you said earlier, which is that, well, that's a poetic way of talking about it. And I think there's something beautiful in that.
I mean, to quickly, you know, validate that too. I mean, I never put magic and science in opposition to each other. Like, science always wins. Like, in terms of viewing the material world and the logical world, I view magic, quote unquote, and I use the word magic because I like it to sound a little bit silly so that people don't take it too seriously.
Right.
It's not a way of seeing the truth of how things are. It's a way of interpreting the world, right? It's an artistic process.
Yes.
It's not a way of discovering objective truth. It's a way of choosing the subjective meanings that you put on top of things.
Yes. Okay, great. Beautiful. Okay, so following that line of thought, perfect. So the subjective universe, the subjective galaxy, this reality tunnel, to use another Robert Anton Wilson phrase. These things, for them to be quantified scientifically and at the material level, in other words, to sort of identify the electrical charges that are happening in the brain or the shifts in energy through the synapses that are what the sum total of those creates a state of, say, joy or a state of epiphany or whatever. We are not there yet. Theoretically possible, but we're not there yet. Maybe we're close. We can scan people's brains. We can see energetic shifts. We're getting closer and closer all the time. But right now, it's safe to say not there. But certainly, science cannot argue with the fact that we hold within us our own subjective universes. And within those universes, there appears to be some kind of physics, in the same way that in the external universe, there's very predictable physics that allow us to shoot satellites into space and understand how to slingshot things around the sun to use its gravity. So that being said, to get back to this concept of contagion and sort of like magical contagion, so to speak, it feels as though sometimes when you get around certain people, the very fabric of your subjective universe begins to warp around them in a really specific way.
The reality distortion field, as yes. They said about Steve Jobs.
Yes. What did they say about Steve?
They said that Steve Jobs had a reality distortion field, and that the people who worked with him were constantly caught up in this. You know, whatever he was doing, that's what was real. That was the story. And a lot of people got totally blown out by that. There were, I think, therapists in the Bay Area whose entire job was to work with people who had worked with Steve Jobs. But I don't think that's a mistake. I mean, Steve Jobs, as we know, did acid. He studied under Neem Karoli Baba. He went to India to meet him. You know, like he was involved in all these practices.
Didn't
well,
get
he
to
missed
see
him. That's correct. Yeah. Yep.
But did he?
Well, there
mean,
you go.
So yes, this reality distortion field, that's what I want to talk about. And it's that moment where, actually, to mention, speaking of Neem Karoli Baba, there's a wonderful book coming out. And I hope this is okay to say. I'm going to say it. I think it's okay to say. But, well, actually, forget the book. I've heard a description of Neem Karoli Baba. There's lots of descriptions of him. But one of the descriptions is he's like a tiger, in the sense that by the time you generally, probably by the time you realize a tiger has decided to eat you, it's too late. The thing's pouncing on you and it's too late. And the same way with him, the moment that it was by the time your brain was catching up with what was happening by being in his presence, it was too late. He got you. You're in there. It's too late. There's really not much you could do. You could run if you want to, or go the other way, or head out, or try to get drunk, or do heroin for a couple of lifetimes, whatever you want to do to try to avoid what just happened. But it's too late. And so in the same way, sometimes when you end up around a person, like I imagine like Crowley or a high sorcerer or something like that, and enter into that reality distortion field, it doesn't really, like at that point, it's like, no, you've gotten in there now, and there's really not much you could do because your subjective universe is being warped by all the work this person has done.
Yes.
Because that thing, I want to talk about that a little bit because it's a
sure.
kind of terrifying, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely terrifying because once you're in somebody's field like that, then you could get stuck there. I think that, and that's how we see these things like cults or
yeah.
people who are, people can cultivate that and it becomes fairly easy to manipulate people. And this is, I think, why you always hear about gurus becoming terrifying and,
yeah.
you know, doing crazy, crazy things and scaring people away, as I often try to do on social media.
How so? Wait, pause. Just, what do you mean?
Oh, just like, I'm a horrible troll on social media. Okay. I'm totally, as you know me, I'm like the most like relaxed Miller
yeah.
like person ever in person. But no, I put on the wrathful deity mask when
no!
I go on social media. But the point is that when you enter into somebody's field like that, your evolution is sped up. And that's what I mean about, you know, when you're in the field of somebody who has that type of cultivation, that Buddha field, and we were talking about Larrigy, right?
Yes.
You have a heightened sense of your own personal potential. The stories that you tell yourself about why you can't do things or why you're stuck, those seem to have less power over you.
Yeah.
They dissipate a little bit, and suddenly you feel like, wait, you know, you have an expanded sense of being alive. Your breathing becomes deeper. And sometimes even by talking about or listening to people talk about somebody like this, like named Karoli Baba, you can start to get a sense of that.
Yeah.
But people are addictive, and they are easily, they become followers. So it's kind of like the opium den. You can't stay there forever, you know?
Right.
Eventually you either have to, you know, and this almost becomes a cliche, but it's like either you become trapped by that. And if you have a good guru, they will force you out of the nest at some point.
Yes.
If you don't, they will essentially enslave you for money or labor or whatever.
Right.
And, the best possible outcome of that is that you get shoved out, that you get disillusioned, and that eventually you cultivate it for yourself if you see through the game. And that's certainly what happened with me, but that's a very painful process.
What happened with you? Who was yours? Can you talk about it?
Yeah. I mean, I had lots of gurus. You know, I spent a lot of time around the Hindu guru system. You know, Genesis Pure is probably my primary guru.
Is there a reality distortion field around Genesis Pure?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you describe what that's like qualitatively? And also, forgive me, two questions, sloppy interview technique. Would you mind just talking a little bit about this being and then describing the field? Maybe it's the same thing.
Yeah, so I met Jen when I was 21. Jen started the band Throbbing Gristle in the early 70s and was one of the people who basically is the person who invented industrial music, who popularized body piercing and tattooing as a major phenomenon during the rave era, and is the person who really popularized the idea of magic, certainly Austin Osman's Spare Sigil magic, in the early 80s through a group called the Temple of Psychic Youth, which is a period that I documented with her in a book called The Psychic Bible, which is this huge hardback that talks about that time period. And Jen has been one of the primary drivers of, you know, human evolution and human potential, you know, during her lifetime. And, you know, has just had a tremendous, tremendous impact on the culture and in the,
but people listening who've never heard of her are like, no, she hasn't. What do you mean? I've never heard of this person. How, what's her impact? I've never heard of this person, because they don't understand, but describe that.
Yeah. It's hard for me to remember that. Cause like, you know, I come out of the occult underworld,
yes,
right? And like crawled out from under the rocks.
Yeah.
And, in the occult world, Jen is like the big, you know, one of the big central figures. Yeah, I think that Jen certainly deserves much, much more broad cultural awareness and acceptance. But Jen has always been so far out there and so strange in a way that people, you know, are just, they don't know what to make. You know, she, Jen and her now passed wife, Lady J, who I miss a lot, underwent in the 2000s, decided to become what they call pandrogynous, where they underwent surgery to look exactly like each other and become a third gender that was neither male nor female, but like Baphomet,
holy
basically.
Holy shit. Because they merged, right? Mm-hmm. They just, because what was happening is they were wanting to reflect what was happening internally, externally, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea.
Absolutely.
They globbed together.
They globbed.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they also, the point of that was that they wanted to break gender. That's not transgender. That's like they wanted to break the category of gender, period.
Right.
Like as something that constrains human consciousness. That
right.
was the idea behind it. So, yeah, I think that Jen will continue to get more and more cultural recognition as somebody who just had a tremendous, tremendous impact on you know, I mean, and you see Jen's influence. I mean, you look at even in the 90s, like people like Marilyn Manson or Nine Inch Nails or Skinny Puppy, like all these bands, and now the mass popularity of magic, things like that, you know, those are all things that Jen did first. So.
And right, exactly. And so, yeah, people, that's what's so cool about people like her is that they're rippling the pond and you're feeling the ripples, but you'll never know that most of the ripples you're feeling, you have no idea. And of course, obviously, whoever rippled Jen's pond or whatever her gurus were.
Yeah, Brian Geisen and William Burroughs.
And keep going back. Because the thing is, you just keep going back. And you can decide wherever you want to stop and make that person the butterfly that made the hurricane happen. But it's like, just keep going back. So anyway, that's a great description of her. Now, tell me a little bit about the distortion field around her. I'm just curious about what it was like to be in her presence for you. And I'd love for you to describe maybe the first few times you got to experience that.
The first time I ever met Jen, I went to her house in 2003 in Ridgewood in Brooklyn. And I had grown up with these very fearsome stories of somebody who's, you know, the wrecker of civilization, as the English press called her. You know, wow. She was thrown out of the UK or went into voluntary exile.
Yeah.
And was this, you know, basically, you know, as they used to call Crowley, the wickedest person in the world, you know. And
what made her wicked? I'm sorry to cut you off, but can you talk a little?
Jen?
Yeah. Not literally that she is wicked, but what were the accusations that were being cast her way?
Well, Jen was the thorn in the side of the English establishment for over a decade. And, you know, starting from the ICA show in London in the 70s, where they walled off an art gallery, they sandbagged an art gallery. Like, they had set up an art exhibition where there were all these kind of sculptures made out of used tampons. And this is early 70s. Like, yeah. This was like, now this is pretty commonplace, right?
Yeah.
Like, then it was like, whoa.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the establishment was going to crack down. The police were going to raid the show. And so they sandbagged the art gallery and had a standoff when it was right next to Whitehall. So that was, you know, a good introduction to English public life. And then from there, I mean, like, Jen started the Temple of Psychic Youth, which at its height in the late 90s had, I think, over 10,000 members.
Right.
At least, you know, on paper. And
so, cult leader.
Yeah. And was just, you know, was constantly telling people to cut up control and, you know, see through the control machine and break the class system and all this stuff. And it was terrifying. It was terrifying, I think, to English society in a way that, you know, like when we were growing up, the way that Marilyn Manson scared, you know, suburban American parents, yes, in the 90s. But I think even more so because, like, no one had ever done this type of thing before. And it was right after Charles Manson, and it was that same sense of, like, you know, like, there were newspaper headlines, you know, this vile man corrupts kids and that type of thing.
Do you think she was scared? Do you think that, like, as this was happening, there was a dawning realization in her that maybe she'd bitten off a little bit more than she could chew here? That it's, like, to really make the decision to wage this kind of psychic war against something is... It seems like you would have to be pretty advanced to fully understand just what you were getting into.
I think maybe, but having been in that position to some extent myself, I would say that when you get into situations like that, if you are a magically minded person, then you mutate on the spot to adapt to it. And you roll with it and you take on the energy and feed it back. You know, it becomes, like you said, a process of energetic exchange. And dealing with that level of energy, you know, cult as a, you know, as I've done many times, you have to become a conduit for the energy. And as long as you remember that you're just a conduit and not regenerating it, or that you're not the source of it, like it doesn't turn into an ego thing. Then you just move through that, and at some point you have to let go and you go on to the next thing, and then you build the next identity.
Got it. Okay, beautiful. Okay, great. Thank you. Now, keep describing this meeting with her, please.
Yeah, so you have to imagine, I mean, I was, I think, 21. I was a very awkward, introverted English student, you know, like University of California literature student. And I'd been doing magic since I was 17, but... I was still, I had not surrendered to it, let me put it that way.
Right.
I hadn't realized what I'd gotten into. And so I went to Jen's house to interview her for Disinfo, actually, because I used to be the books editor for Disinfo. And I was expecting this fearsome person. And the person that I met was a very, very polite, kind of very English, like, oh, come in, have a cup of tea, you know, let's sit down at the table and talk about things. And just very, very warm, loving.
That's great.
And one of the people that I met that is just purely loving and giving and supportive. And the first thing that Jen said, I interviewed her, and we talked in her office, and I met Lady J, who was an amazing, amazing person, and you know, just absolutely incredible. And I had that sense of expanded potential. Like, I had a sense of expanded potential, and I also had a sense, because I was so young and so insecure, I had a sense of, why are these, you know, famous, legendary people interacting with me and even talking to me and being supportive and being nice to me?
Yeah.
It was like that itself was a real head trip. But
did you ever answer that question?
Which question?
Why they're hanging out with you?
Well, I think that became clear over time, because I was certainly put up to do a job by Jen. And the first thing, Jen mentioned that she had interns during our interview.
I'm sorry, how did she find you?
How did Jen find me?
Yeah.
I found her, because at that time, I was still learning about magic, and I had set myself up a goal where I was going to interview all the big magicians. So I interviewed Jen, I interviewed Graham Morrison, I interviewed a bunch of other people. I think those were the main ones. And through that, I got a job at Disinfo, which is how I got my first book, Generation Hex, out. And I just inserted myself into the story very consciously.
Gotcha.
Where I had done enough magic where it's like, okay, I want to know, I want to learn. If I'm going to do this, I want to learn from the people who are the best at it.
Got it.
And so I inserted myself in the story, and I said, and I asked Jen mentioned that she'd had interns, and I said, do you need another one? And she said, why, yes, you seem very intelligent. And so that began a long period of working with Jen. And the last thing that Jen said to me on our first meeting was, now you have to do it.
Fuck.
And I was like, holy, like, you can imagine my reaction. Like, again, you know, like, nerdy 21-year-old with acne and a parka.
Yeah.
You know, just like, what?
Just,
you know,
thrown
still
into
trying
the,
to figure out, you know, women.
Thrown into the lake.
Thrown into the lake.
Thrown into the lake.
And that's my origin story, in a way, you know, and that's, and that was shortly after 9/11 happened, or maybe, and, you know, I had a very different life lined up for myself, where I probably by now would have been, you know, an English professor somewhere with, you know, a very, very basic life, you know, teaching students, maybe writing short stories for publications. And instead I became the black shaman of the apocalypse. So.
Now, wait. Hold on now. Hold on. But now I want to talk. You still haven't. You've described the initial form that she presented to you,
right,
which was very compassionate of her to do. And it was certainly an assessment of where you were at, knowing that if she were to reveal, like, the other aspects right off the bat, who knows how that... She understood that was probably not the most, pragmatic way of interacting with you right away. But did you... Was there a point, or... Do you recall a point when you were around her where you begin to get an inkling of the deeper thing behind that mask of English politeness or courtesy?
Actually, I would say it was the opposite. I think that one of the most radical things about Jen was that in my interactions with Jen and my interactions with Jen now is this is a way of life. You know, magic is not, you know, people get crazy pie in the sky ideas about magic, like, oh, you must be walking around in robes,
yeah,
like, just throwing pentagrams at, sure, the walls, and it's not at all. It's a way of life. It's a, you know, the whole point is to be conscious, and particularly in your interactions with other people, and to,
right,
give people love, because love is the energy of evolution. I know that sounds cheesy, but it's what we're just talking about now. It's the Buddha field. It's the sense that when people come into your field, you see them, you show them in every way that you can that they matter, because,
right,
that's what people don't have now. They live in a culture in which you know, a relentlessly dehumanizing culture that sees people as drones, you know, as replaceable cogs.
Ugh.
And so the radical message of certainly my interactions with Jen and you got to remember, this is a person that I know and I have known in my life since 2003. So it's really hard for me to talk about them in, you know, grandiose terms. Like, this is my friend Jen. But the whole point is to, you know, where you are with somebody, that's what matters. You're with somebody. The fact that we're both conscious now in this time, in this period, having this moment as two conscious beings with an expanded sense of reality, and it's not in a pretentious way, it's not in a You know, I'm going to put a coil shirt on way, you know, it's not, yeah. It's not in a black robe way. It's in a very human, holistic sense of, you know, this is where we are. This is what matters. You matter, you know, you listening to this matter, you know, your life and your views and your opinions, those are incredibly important.
Yeah.
You know, you as a locus, on this universe as a way of, you as a point that is viewing this universe and all the things you've experienced and all the things you will experience and all the things that you're capable of and all the things that you're capable of giving, that matters. It really, really matters. What matters more, you know?
Right.
So that's, maybe that gives you a little bit of a sense of it, but it...
That gives a big sense of it.
Okay.
Because that's so psychedelic. And that in its own way is to... I mean, talk about apocalyptic for a person. You know, I was reading, I pulled off the shelf after having a chance to, side note, I don't know if I've been doing this for a long time or I just started, but some, you guys, Louvre's book, holy shit, it's really good. And he's very modest. It's fucking crazy. And so after reading what you sent me, and being like, what the fuck? I pulled Eliphas Levi back off. How do you say his name?
Levy, I think. French. Yeah, French
yeah. name. I yanked him off the shelf and like dove into that fucking heady translation, which is why I was asking you about Contagion, because that's part of the chapter on bewitchments that I was checking out. But one of the things he said in there that I found really fascinating and spectacular was that to be kind can be a way to do a lot of, quote, harm to a really rotten person. In other words, like, by being kind around the version of to be super kind around a damaged identity or a suffer, an ego that is, like, feeding off of rejection and has made its life that of being rejected, to suddenly be kind around that is in an odd way to be an existential threat to that mask. You know, do you know what I'm saying?
And an existential threat to that part of you, because we all have that part of ourselves.
Yeah.
Right? The hungry ghost.
Yes, the hungry right. ghost. So when you get around a being that is giving you unconditional positive regard, and not just in the way that, like, I think a lot of us practice it, which is a great way, which is like, I don't know you, but even though I don't know you, I'm going to try to, like, love you as best I can. Some people have developed the ability to look deep into or scanning through you, seeing the trap that you're in, and then like melting that trap through this kind of telepathic ultra love thing. And that will destroy your identity. That is a cataclysm or a personal apocalypse, is certainly an apocalypse in the sense of the lifting of the veil to reveal what's underneath that mask. So this is again, when I mentioned being around some of these beings is treacherous, I mean treacherous to like the current identity that you're trying to present to the world. Because when you're around something that melts that fucking thing, no matter how much you've cultivated being the coil shirt wearing darkling lord of the night. And you... And you get around the fucking, like, big love beam, the Dharma field. You get pulled into the thing, and then you get this weird amnesia, mm-hmm. you know, where you're like, I think I was something when I got around you, but now your wheels are spinning as you're trying yep. to go back. That is powerful, man. That's a powerful fucking thing to be in the presence of.
It really is. Yeah, it really helps. That helped me. You know, I came out of a long period in my early 20s of, you know, I just went, I think probably talked about this on the podcast before, but I just went through just the darkest possible stuff that I could, you know, demons and Galatia and voodoo and the Cliffoth. And like, I went through
all the Cliffoth. P.S. I mean, I kind of know that I know voodoo. Galatia, I know a little bit. Definitely many people living might not know that, but maybe you could just sort of quickly define what those things
are. Galatia is demons, demon conjuration, and the Cliffoth is the reverse of the Tree of Life. the negative, the antimatter version of the Sephiroth.
The fuck is that? I've never heard of that.
This is one of these things I say I feel like I shouldn't say on your podcast, because, you know, there, whenever I get on your podcast, by the way, I have to let you do like a mental checklist of like things I should and should not say, because there's certain things that, you know, like, you know, people can be impressionable, and
that's what I love about magic, because magic versus Eastern mysticism, even though it certainly with some of the teachings, there's like, so like in conveying like ideas of Buddhism or talking about the guru, there's a kind of grace or a kind of cultivated tactfulness that needs to go along with it, because what you don't want to do is be clumsy in the way you're saying it and describe it from your reality tunnel where you're at, which is like, you know, for example, if I were to describe it from my reality tunnel, what might come out right now at this point in my life is very gooey, very woo-woo-y, very filled with like, oh my fucking God, are you, this is what, this is real. And then from that's going to be almost like a disjointed, unharmonized, potentially a manifestation of some fear of it going away. It's all going to be imbalanced. The point is, it won't be graceful enough to like potentially, it could potentially turn people off, which is not a good thing to do, because...
Oh, I'd rather they be turned off than actually get into it.
Well, that's magic. But with this, you know, I see what you're saying there. Yeah, right. I see what you're saying. Again, the point is to become a refined articulator of these kinds of things is to become a better healer, so to speak.
Sure, because, sure.
But with magic, and what I love about magic, no, and in that I include Tantra. Like, I have this book, yes. Agora over here.
Oh, Agora. I did that for a while. That's... Yeah, that's a whole nother ball of human flesh.
It's a big ball of human flesh. And it's in it went, but all
I mean, I met some of the big Agoris in Kathmandu, and with Jen actually in 2010.
You went to Kathmandu?
I've been a couple times, yeah.
With her?
Yeah, the first time I went to Kathmandu, which is my favorite place on earth, was shortly after I met Jen, and I ended up becoming initiated as a Nepali Jhongri shaman.
Holy shit.
Which, again, helped kill that awkward English student.
Hold on. I'm so sorry, man. I mean, again, like, I can't blame you for talking about this as though it's just common, because it's your life. But we're going to have to, like, when these moments, like, put the microscope up, or at least the magnifying glass up.
Sure.
Because we can't just say, oh, is in Kathmandu a Genesis Fjord.
Yeah, that was a great trip though. We went for Mahashivaratri in 2010.
And, dude,
we were hanging out with all these Agori and Nath Babas and Naga Babas.
Okay, hold on. I'm sorry. Before we get there, I'm so sorry. Let me just, I like doing this. I'm learning how to do it, and I like walking through it, but only so that we can really like enjoy the meal. So I want to start with the plane ride. Were you sitting next to her on the plane to India, or did you meet her there?
No, actually, she was going with my friend Hannah. I went, and I actually showed up at their doorstep in Kathmandu, because I was planning on going anyways. I hung out with them in Kathmandu for 10 days, and then after that, I went up with another crew up into the Himalayas, like 18,000 feet up into the Himalayas, and got to go to the birthplace of Shiva and the birthplace of Ganesh, and meditate at the shrine where Ram meditated before the Ramayana war and all this stuff. But I was in Kathmandu for 10 days with them. So I went and I met up with them first, and then yeah, we were just kind of hanging out. And
what does that look like?
Which part?
The hanging out with Genesis Pjorge in Kathmandu. What does that look like?
Too many drugs.
What kind of drugs?
I probably shouldn't say on the air, but you know, there's a lot of legal stuff in
Just a lot of legal stuff. So, you know, like probably like nicotine rubs, I'm guessing, yeah. And like some kind of like
nicotine patches.
And alcohol tinctures.
Tinctures,
so,
yes.
Yeah, so you're doing like tinctures of alcohol and nicotine creams and rubs. And so you're doing magic. And you're doing magic in this way through psychedelics. And there you are, Genesis.
Well, yeah, when you get into, Kathmandu. When you get into psychedelic states, or, you know, super intense psychedelic states, you know, it's like you're surrounded by the way, Kathmandu is normal psychedelic places on earth. It's a valley that has been inhabited by Hindus, Buddhists, and shamans for 2000 years.
Wow.
And they all share the same gods in the same shrines. and the whole city is a temple. Everything is a shrine. Everything is a, it's like a gigantic, Jen described it as a gigantic computer, like a cult computer. Fuck. Where it's like you go around, everyone's just doing magic nonstop.
Jesus
and those shrines
Christ.
Have been there since, you know, 14th century or before. And these are people who know what they're doing. I mean, in the West, we have, you know, a very, very, you know, what do we have? We have since, like you said, Levy, you know, we have a few Golden Dawn things. Like Western magic is really fairly underpowered compared to, you know, the hardcore Tibetan or Hindu stuff and those meditation practices, those people who have been, you know, the Tibetans, they've been doing nothing but meditating and exploring altered states of consciousness and other realities for, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years with basically people just there to facilitate that state. And, or a feudal society, if you want to put it that way. But, you know, we have no conception. We literally have no conception. So to go into those states, you know, that we think are a big deal here, it's like you're just beginning. When you're out in those crazy psychedelic states over there, it's like maybe you have a little bit of a vantage point where you can see, you know, what where they're at, which is beyond the beyond. So
didn't you feel like you were losing your mind, man? Didn't you feel at points in
no.
that place? You'd never
I felt at home. I felt like I was losing. Well, the first time I went, which is by myself, I went to India afterwards, and I sat on the bank in the Ganges watching bodies burn for like a week and meditating on mortality. And I did feel a little bit like I was losing it in India, but that was mostly because of the crushing poverty and alienation and bureaucratic nature of that country. I love India. It's one of my favorite places ever, there in Kathmandu, Nepal. But India is much less colorful and shamanic. It's much more industrial.
Right.
So I felt so, I did feel a little bit like I was losing in India, but that was mostly just because I had been isolated and by myself for a long period of time. And I was in such an extreme place, but no, you know, Nepal, they say, you know, they abbreviate Nepal, their never ending peace and love.
So, that's cool. But one thing I know about you is that no matter what I ask, there's things you did in there with Genesis Peorge that you're not going to talk about or even indicate that you did, because that's part of what magic is. And forgive me if that is too much, but that's what I love about magic is that, and what's really cool and interesting about it is not an open book. It is systematic. And in those each, it seems like there's these gates. And each gate is an initiation into a deeper part of the thing. And I guess those gates are placed there not out of some kind of sense of prejudice or pretension, but to...
No, it's to protect people. And I think that's a very... that's definitely a very psychedelic way of putting it. I look at it as, you know, like I put myself in this role where I've opened the gates of magic to people and I'm constantly educating people on it. And I've got... You know, maybe 30,000-40,000 people have passed through the courses that I put online. You know, I've got people in Africa doing my rituals, things like this. And I've kind of put myself in this position where I'm welcoming people to the party, and that's for certain reasons, long-term political reasons that I've chosen to do that. But
what do you mean long-term political reasons?
Well, I want people to be, you know, I want the power to be with the masses and not the elites.
You mean you'd rather just, right, I see what you're saying. Why?
Because we have, the time is too short. You know, we face, you know, we could lose this world within a generation. You know, like, I don't know if you saw, they put up that, there was this terribly sad video that went online of a polar bear starving to death on an ice floe.
I've seen that.
Yeah, what the fuck, right? When we're facing the potential death of the planet, you know, not the planet, but of life as we understand it, if human society within 100 years through global warming and our leaders are like Donald Trump, for instance,
yeah,
then my view, and many people might argue with this, but my view is then we don't have time for the formalities. We don't have time for these structures that were created 2,000 years ago. Like for even Buddhism, you know, the whole Mahayana Buddhist thing of saving everybody and everyone's got to become a Buddha and all this stuff. Like those ideologies were created when there were 250 million people on the planet.
Right.
You know, like we got 7 million people and growing now.
Yes.
And the clock is ticking and we live in the apocalypse for all intents and purposes. these systems that were designed to slowly turn people on over 40 years, yeah, they're probably better than making it a mass thing, but we're out of time, you know, and that's the political call that I've made on it. But to your point about, you know, how do you protect people from going in too far? You know, I put myself in this position where it's kind of, if you imagine me, like, I'm here, come into my living room, you know, like I'm welcoming you to the party of magic that has been kept secret and elite for so long. It's kind of like, you know, I might be like, here's a joint, smoke this, right?
Yeah.
But I'm not going to be like, here's some ketamine, inject this, right? You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like, you know, and you kind of got to give it, or it's like if someone's just getting into hot food, you know, you can say, here's like one jalapeno on an omelet, right? Not like here, you know, do the...
Gotcha.
These, have you seen these like, my new favorite video genre is the people eating crazy hot peppers on YouTube and turning purple.
Yeah.
And like eating these things with like 100 million Scoville units or something like that.
Have you seen? Well, I mean, there's an incredible interview series. Have you seen it where the guy feeds people successively hotter hot wings as he interviews them about their life?
Oh my god,
it's really, really funny.
I love those videos. I gotta find that. I haven't seen that one, but
yeah, man. Well, it seems like, well, one of the things you're talking about that I've thought of, and it's interesting to hear you talk about it, is that the more the environment collapses, the more likely we're going to start seeing sorcerers who are going to come out of hiding because they have to deal with the problem of losing their planet. And they I think if you have this viewpoint, then certainly others like you must have the viewpoint as well, right?
Maybe. I mean, but look, I mean, it's already happened. Just walk outside, you know, just walk down the street of any youth area in the first world, you know, London, New York, Los Angeles, all these fucking kids are into magic.
Right.
You know, and I had a role in that. Jen had a role in that. Richard Metzger had a role in that. You know, Grant Morrison had a huge role in that. You know, like, we've been working on this for a while, and now here we are, and it's a little bit annoying now that it's happened, to be honest, because everyone's, like, you know, wearing our clothes. But
do you mean by wearing your clothes?
Well, everyone thinks they're a magician now. You know, it's like, and the first developmental stage for magicians is thinking they're the center of the universe, and their ego gets really, really big, and it's a little intolerable to get around. You know?
Okay, I want to talk to you about this,
yeah.
And I'm glad you said it that way, because this has been, and anything I say to you, man, comes out of respect. I love you. You're awesome, and I love what you're doing, but I do want to talk about something, and I want to say it, I want to preface it with all due respect.
Okay.
What I've noticed in magic versus like, and like, arguably, you could say, look, man, what isn't magic? Like, you keep making this stupid differentiation between the East and the West or whatever, but please let me do that in a kind of neophyte way for now. But what I've noticed is that in magic in particular, there seems to be more of a heightened ego, an egoism.
Absolutely.
So what we're looking at is, this is annoying to me because these people are doing this thing. Now, actually, now that I think about it, Ram Dass talks about how let me fix what I just said now I think about it, because actually Ram Dass talks about how he came to the West, tried to keep Neem Karoli Baba a secret, but people figured it out, and then how he was fucking annoyed because all these people suddenly were around Neem Karoli Baba and getting his attention, and he didn't get the attention anymore. But that being said, I have noticed in magic a type of egoism that you don't find in those other practices. I wonder if you can address that a little bit.
Well, there's no question. And I think that, you know, the whole, you know, the will, capital W, and making yourself a big deal. And this is what I will say about that. It is a developmental stage that magicians go through. For many of them, it is a critical developmental stage that they go through, because you got to put this in context. The developmental stage that becomes before that stage is the one of feeling totally disempowered.
Right.
Right. It's the sense of, it's the stage of feeling like you don't matter. Everyone thinks you're an asshole. Your teachers don't like you. Your parents are on your case. People have told you you're never going to amount to anything.
Right.
You know, reality is relentlessly alienating. The best you can hope for is maybe a job that will pay you enough to, you know, like, tune out in front of Netflix and play video games.
Right.
And that's all you're ever going to hope for from this life.
Fuck.
Right. And that's what people are offered in the society.
Right.
So that's the stage. So yes, of course, when they get into this stuff and when they get into magic, they're looking for a way out into something better.
Right.
Right. So of course, and I think it's a critical, I mean, and you look at human beings when they're 2 years old, they become terrible, the terrible twos, you know, they become human beings just go through egoistic stages. The ego becomes immense. When people become teenagers, when they go through adolescence, the ego becomes monstrous and intolerable. And so I think that just to say like, oh, people shouldn't have an ego. Well, that's kind of a cop out too, because right. I think that sometimes people do need an ego and they do need to be empowered and they do need to, big themselves up. And, but of course that stage becomes a trap too, because then eventually, what you realize is nothing happens and you can't do anything by yourself. We live in a society of people. And if you're going to do anything in this life, you need to work with other people. You can't do everything by yourself.
Okay. Can you give some advice to those of us who are struggling with our ego? What are some ways, are there magical ways? Cause you know, when you start having an ego flare up, and you do, I know what you're talking about, exactly what I do know what you're talking about. And I do know that feeling of suddenly walking into the magical universe and realizing, oh my fucking God, no one knows about this. Or I know people know about it. No one around me knows about this shit. And it's real. This is not bullshit. This is not, holy fuck. This is real. I am doing this now.
Well, that's where you slipped right there.
Oh, right. I am doing this.
Yep.
Okay. Let's talk about it though, because I would like to hear, like, in the same way, if I get a muscle spasm, I know how to get rid of that. What are some magical techniques if we start getting an ego spasm? What are some things that we could do to reduce that swelling?
The first thing I think is just don't get a, you know, like the whole turn off your ego thing, you know, became a real, okay. So actually I wrote something about this. So in the 60s, it became very, very fashionable to talk about turning off your ego,
uh-huh.
right? And a lot of that came out of that really strong acid that people were doing, that Owsley was giving around. And like, there was this group, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, right? And they were giving people this acid that was it's like 800 times more powerful than the stuff that people get now. Yeah. And people can barely even get it now. But, and it was like a thing. It's like, it was like this macho alpha thing. Like, you have to delete your ego.
Yeah.
And even Charles Manson, you know, he had that song, you know, ego is a too much thing and all that. It was just part of the,
what's the song that the Beach Boys stole from Charles Manson?
Hang on to your ego.
No, it's called like, no, the Beach Boys might call it Hang on to your ego. Is that a song?
Yeah, that's a Beach Boys song from that time.
The Charles Manson song is actually the opposite of that, which is so funny. Hold on, because it's, let me look it up.
Charles Manson, R.I.P.
Manson Beach Boys song. It's called, it's Manson's most favorite song, and it's called, let's see, it's called, hold on, fuck. It's called something like Annihilate Yourself. hold on, wait. I truly have to find it. I'm going to press pause. We can just talk while I'm looking. I just
The infamous Beach Boys song, Sell All Your Possessions, Give Them to Charles Manson, and Move Into a Van in the Middle of the Desert and Do What He Says.
Okay, let me look. Let's see. Yeah, I know, but this is what I love about Charles Manson's songs is that theoretically, if a tiger could sing, right? A tiger's going to sing about shit that tigers do, you know?
Like, oh, yeah,
stalking things, eating things, probably fucking, probably like just whatever. I don't know what tigers are up to when they're not like eating shit or running around together. But, you know, in the same way, I bet a tiger's going to be, it's like that fantastic Chris Rock joke where a tiger got out and ate a bunch of people in a zoo. And he said a news report was like, a tiger escaped and went crazy. And Chris Rock's joke is, that tiger didn't go crazy. That tiger went tiger. That's what it did. So in the same way, Charles Manson, his songs are exactly what you would expect a cult leader to sing. You know
what I mean? Well, yeah. I mean, he was the same. He was in jail his entire life and they let him out for like, you know, a few months and like, you know, he Charles Mansoned all over the place.
He Charles Mansoned it up, dude. And like, let me just find his songs. It's called, because it's so funny, Charles Manson songs, and it does relate to Annihilate, Cease to Exist.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Cease to exist.
How could I forget?
Yeah, and so yeah, this was embracing this concept of dissolve your ego, except I'm not going to dissolve mine. A cult leader says to everyone around them, get rid of your fucking ego.
Right.
But I'm hanging on to mine.
Yeah, something that should be best done on your own instead of under somebody else's...
tutelage?
Yeah, that's a tricky one. I would say this. I think that we had this... In the 60s, this culture, meaning the West, whatever you want to call it, started to open up the gates to these things in a really serious way because of psychedelics. Before that, we'd had things like yoga and Yogananda and Ramakrishna and theosophy and table tapping and spiritualism, and it had been around forever, yeah. You know. But because of psychedelics, people started going into these states without any training whatsoever and just like, okay, here you go. You want it? Here it is. And losing it because they had no way to contextualize or right. navigate that experience. It's like throwing somebody onto the freeway without knowing how to drive or whatever Whoa, metaphor you want to use.
Oh, shit.
Really, that's what it is. And so people got this super macho idea of, oh, you have to delete your ego. It's like, no, you don't have to delete your ego, okay? You need to heal your ego because you need to directly engage with your ego. To delete your ego is spiritual bypassing. You know, what you want to do is look at your ego, understand the places that it's been hurt, work through it in whether that's through therapy or something else, but directly work with it and work with your humanity. Don't try to become, you know, a lot of times people get into magic and they're trying with all their might to become something that they're not. It's like you got to do the work of alchemy. That means working with prima materia. That means working with, you know, you want to turn base lead into gold. You got to start with base lead. You got to work through the damaged parts of your human personality, because otherwise what happens is you get all the cities and all that turned on. You know, you start doing magic and then that gets filtered through a damaged conduit. And then the parts of your personality that are unhealed become monstrous. And that's what we see with people like Crowley or Adida or Chogyam Trungpa or some of these other gurus that kind of went off the deep end. Or people who just, you know, become acid casualties in general, or what you're talking about, just kind of, you know, and I've certainly been in that place myself. You know, I've been in some pretty damaged and dark and unhealthy, places myself. So I speak from just human experience, not from saying like, oh, you know, there's a right way to do things.
I gotcha. That's beautiful. It's kind of like, yeah, it's like you want to, if you're going to. I get it. The way I'm thinking about it is, unfortunately, like, okay, it's like before you fly the helicopter, you want to make sure every part of the helicopter is like been refined enough for your, I get it. Okay. I get it. That's cool. I get it.
Cause we come into this world damaged. You know, this world is like a hospital in many ways, or a insane asylum. You know, it's like everyone is a wounded robot on this planet. Holy we all shit. Have wounds that we're carrying around, not to sound like I'm a therapist or whatever, but we all have wounds that we're carrying around. Just from living, you know, whether it's from childhood or from traumas or whatever, we all have them, right? So that's the unglamorous work of magic is, you know, to inquire within and to work with that stuff and just to slowly pick that stuff out, whether it's through meditation, through therapy. Sometimes psychedelics can certainly help, but they shouldn't be the thing that you rely on. It shouldn't be just psychedelics.
Right.
You know, as we unpack these things and unpick them and heal them and look at them and mature through them, grow through them, accept them, because you can't change the past, but you can heal and become adult around the things that have happened to you. That is a process of power and gaining power because it makes you a whole human being.
Right.
And so that is what the approach I recommend instead of, you know, becoming Fruza Balk in the craft. And
becoming what?
Fruza Balk in the craft, okay. You know, and just keep becoming reference. Like becoming like the totally high strung, like goth sorcerer,
yeah.
Which I've certainly been. But that, you know, for me, the whole great work, quote unquote, is becoming more human, becoming a better human being.
Wow.
And sometimes we're on certain days, we're better at that than others. But I will say that when you asked about what the key is. When you said that, oh, I'm doing this magic, the key is not to attach. And in fact, I forget the word, the Tibetans, instead of talking about, like the Hindus, right? The Hindus talk about cities. They talk about magical powers, right? Which is the biggest ego trap there is.
right,
to believe that you have magic power. This is a seven-year-old's way of thinking.
Right.
You know, seven-year-olds think that they have magical agency over the world. It's a childhood psychological stage.
Yes.
So the Hindus talk about cities, and the Western tradition talks about magical powers and all this. And both of those traditions tell you not to cultivate them, to cultivate meditation instead. And they also use those as goads or enticements to move people along the path.
Right.
But the Tibetans have a different word for it. And I'm sorry, I can't remember what it is. But instead of talking about cities, they have a word for it where it basically means things that happen. Like something, some crazy synchronicity happens.
Yes.
Or some insane thing that makes no sense whatsoever happens. Like, yes, this person just showed up out of the blue, called you and that you were talking about them, and whatever it is, it's not that you have magical powers. It's like, oh, that happened. Huh. And Jen actually has a great phrase for this, which is the of course syndrome. You know, so hanging out with Jen, always crazy magical things would happen, and Jen say, oh, of course. You know, why did that happen? Because of course it would happen. You know, it's so not like, cool, oh, with my great magical power, you, I created. No,
I got you.
Because it's not true either. It's like, you know, the universe is inherently magical. The universe is a magical process, and the whole point of magic is to become aware of that, and to think that you're doing it is a slip.
Got it. Beautiful. And but all that being said, can you address for a moment? Okay, so like, you know the feeling, and I know you must know this feeling, where the of courses are happening and so many of courses, you're like, oh my, you really are like, oh my God, what is this? Oh my God, the of courses are off the chain. And then they stop. The sense of being like, where, you know what I mean? Where the those little synchronicities or the big synchronicities or the little winks from the universe or the big winks from the universe, they're just gone. And it's they dry up. How do we deal with that state? And is it possible? Is there some practice to increase the chance that those things will start happening again?
That's a great question. So, yeah, I mean, this state, I think Crowley calls this dryness, and St. John of the Cross even refers to that as the dark night of the soul, or that's actually a different experience. But any mystic you read will talk about this. Everything will seem perfect. Like, everything in your life is lining up. You feel like the sense of love from the universe. Yeah. And like, you're getting this kind of, people always get this when they start, by the way. It's like beginner's luck.
Yeah.
Excuse me. At some point, yes, it does dry up, and it's kind of like you get thrown out of the party and you have a hangover at 5 a.m. and you're, yeah, wandering down the street in the Lower East Side, like feeling like shit. Right.
Yes.
And, it means it's time to go back to the mat. Right. It means, okay, well, all right, the light show's over, but look, the light show was not the point. The point, right, is, as I said, you know, becoming more human. The point is meditating. The point is working through your knots, right? The point is therapy. The point is becoming more of who you are. And when you're in those states, the point is not to give up, that number one. The point is to stop and rethink. And by the way, this state comes for human beings no matter what it is they're doing. It's not just magic. It's if you're a martial artist, if you're a musician, if you're an artist, if you're doing a job, whatever it is, whatever skill that you're trying to become good at is working out, whatever it is, there will be plateau periods or period. Because when people first start doing something, there's a really quick ramp up period where all their, you know, they're doing it really well, and they're actually not doing it right. It's in NLP, it's called unconscious incompetence. Unconscious incompetence. You have to go from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence.
Oh shit. Ouch.
Meaning you have to become aware,
gotcha,
of what,
ouch,
you're doing wrong.
Ouch. Yeah, well, okay.
But it's only from the place of conscious incompetence, and that's when you want to get a mentor. That's when you want to, yeah, take a course. That's when you want to hit the books. That's, yeah, when you want to commit to at least one practice, not everything in the world, at least, you know, 30 minutes of meditation a day, let's say.
Yeah.
And not to overstrain yourself, but just one thing that you can commit to.
Yeah.
And this is where your mettle is tested. Is this really the path for you? Because this is the part where the people who this is not for get thrown out.
Gotcha.
You're out of the club and you're not coming back in.
Gotcha.
Unless you prove that you are worthy, right? And by do and to prove that you are worthy, and this is not just magic, but any skill, means that you put in the blood, sweat, and tears, the unglamorous work, the parts where you just want to give it all up, but yeah. you keep going.
Yeah.
And then you work through your, then it's only in that stage that you work from. And that means, yeah, journaling. What am I doing wrong? How can I meet somebody who can show me how to do it correctly? Right. And going from conscious incompetence, it's from there that you go from conscious incompetence slowly, slowly to conscious competence. You get a pattern that works, a system that works, a routine that works. Yeah. You figure out what works for you and what doesn't, what resonates and what doesn't. And then you hone down and drill down and get really good at those things. And it's only from conscious competence that you now go to unconscious competence, which is the state of mastery, right? Which is where it just is natural.
Yes.
And that's true of anything.
Jason Louv, thank you so much. This has been an enlightening conversation. How can prospective students find your living room?
So same deal as always when I come on. So my website is magic.me, magick.me, and you will find everything you need to get started. Video trainings on meditation, chaos magic, ceremonial magic, astral projection, tarot, everything you need to start to navigate into these states of consciousness and how to practice and drill down and start to get really good at it. And the lucky thing is, because I've been working on this book, I'm now coming back to this and there's going to be a lot more content this year. So it's magic.me, magick.me. If you use the code DTFH,
nice.
It's 20% off.
Cool.
Your first month of a subscription. And of course, I also have to, Duncan mentioned it, my book at long last, John D. and the Empire of Angels is coming out April 17th. It is already available for pre-order, and you can see it at johnd007.com. So that's the numbers, 007, John D, johndee007.com. And this is the best possible book on magic that I could have written. I put everything I had into it. I spent every waking moment of the last 3 years working on it. It is the story of exactly what Western magic is, how it shaped our world, what it really is underneath all the glamour. And it's the story of John Dee, Edward Kelly, Aleister Crowley, Jack Parsons, Marjorie Cameron, the goddess Babylon, what Thelemic magic is, what angelic magic is, how the angels are trying to cause the apocalypse, how we're all caught up in this occult apocalypse machine, and how to maybe see through it. It's 560 pages. It's hardback. Duncan was very, very, you were very, very gracious to provide a quote for it.
And, shit, what an honor, man. It's so good. You could tell you poured your life into that thing. It's really cool, man.
Yeah, so I'm actually just coming back to becoming more public after, because I was literally doing, just rented a tiny little office, and I was just in there working on that book nonstop for, 24/7 for 2 years, and then another year of additional work. If you want to know the big picture, that's the one to get.
I'll have all the links at duncantrussell.com. Thank you, Jason.
Thanks, Duncan.
Thanks so much for listening, pals. That was Jason Louv. Check him out over at magic.me. Much thanks to casper.com for sponsoring this episode. We will be back next week with a conversation with Dr. Cole Marta, who is running the phase 3 clinical trials of MDMA in Los Angeles for MAPS. It's a great conversation. I'll see you then. Hare Krishna.